In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the American West and about how not only the way that we think about it, but the place itself was shaped by transportation. Particularly here, we're talking about the more modern modes of transportation, the railroad, the automobile, and the airplane. And our guest for the program this morning is Carlos Arnaldo Suarez. He is the author of a recently published book, which is titled Going Places, Transportation Defines the 20th Century West. He's an historian that has written quite a bit about the West and also about transportation. He is the St. Louis Mercantile Library Endowed Professor of Transportation Studies and the West at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. He is author or editor of 14 books. Another recent one is titled Columbia River Gateway to the West. He's talking with us by telephone this morning. And as we talk, questions from people listening are certainly welcome. All we ask is people are brief, and we just ask that so we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone would be welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. But we do have that toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And it's good if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana. If you would happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you could use that too. 800-222-9455. And here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Professor Suarez, hello.
How are you, David?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Delighted to do so.
I know according to the information I hear that it came with the book, it said that you got your PhD in Michigan. Where did you grow up?
Indiana.
Indiana. So you're a Midwesterner. So how did this fascination with the West come about?
I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan and was looking for a job, and the job offer came from the state of Washington, from a college in the state of Washington. And so in 1969, I left the Midwest and went to Washington, later Idaho. And then in the early part of the present millennium, I moved back to the Midwest in St. Louis. So it's kind of after 32 years, the circle comes back around.
Mm. Well, I can certainly understand anyone becoming fascinated with the West, because it has its own particular beauty. Sometimes it can be stark, but beautiful nonetheless. And I think one of the things that's really enjoyable about the book is that it has a lot of really wonderful photographs here, older pictures that show the West as it was, and particularly concentrate on things like, some just spectacular pictures of some of the most astounding railroad trestles I think I have ever seen, and wonderful pictures of mining towns, and I guess that some of the pictures that appeal to me most, I suppose, are those that somehow involve trains, and give you a feeling for the place and its stark and fierce beauty.
Well, when I was in high school in Indianapolis, I took a class in photography, and of all the classes, I think in high school that benefited me the most, that would rank near the top. And for years I was an amateur photographer, and then suddenly I realized that I could use my knowledge of what makes a good photograph in doing more serious work. And so I really scoured the country for photographs for different books that I have done, and this is one of the ones I enjoy the most because of, as you say, the photographs are turned out to be really outstanding. Mm-hmm. I can't take any credit for that. I just was the locator of the photographs. There were wonderful photographers over the years that captured the West and the trains and so forth, and I was just simply trying to find the best of the lot.
Yeah. And obviously here, this is something that since we're talking on the radio, it's difficult. We can perhaps describe some if the occasion comes up. But I would suggest that people, if they can, go and take a look at the book because there's a lot of wonderful stuff here. Were there particular photographs that were photographers that were known for doing some of these panoramic, very dramatic panoramic nature shots that seem calculated to be you know, postcard material or poster card poster material designed to get people to say, oh, I want to go there.
You're exactly right. The West was, in many ways, unknown in the 19th century. And railroad companies in particular would hire commercial photographers to do images of the West that the railroads could put in promotional brochures that they distributed by the millions around the eastern half of the United States and even in Europe. And so these photographers were often given specific instructions, show the bountiful crops or show the incredible beauty of the Rocky Mountains or the Sierras or the Cascade Mountains. And the railroads would then make those images freely available. In some cases, they were postcards, but more often than not, they ended up in brochures, very stunning brochures with color covers at a time when color covers are fairly rare. And all of them, of course, were designed to get people to want to go west to tour the region, preferably by the railroad that is issuing the brochure, or actually to settle there. The American West was very sparsely populated in comparison with the East, and so the railroads felt the need to develop the traffic along their tracks in a way that Eastern railroads didn't seem to have to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think about the many stories about how particularly some of the pitches that were made to try to get people to settle promised things that maybe didn't exist. That is, they were painting a picture of a place that wasn't really real. And I would guess if what you were trying to do was promote tourism, you couldn't really do that. You actually had to show what it really was so that when people got there, they would be impressed or even say, well, this is even better than the postcard. When particularly railroads did that, or whoever was promoting the place, was promoting a particular image of the place, did they really do a good job of showing it as it was, or were there ways in which they were creating a place that didn't actually exist?
More often than not, they were taking a place that had some fantastic dimensions to it visually and embellishing on those. A series of brochures put out by the Northern Pacific Railroad, which connected St. Paul in Minnesota with Puget Sound, was titled Wonderland. And that was kind of their concept, that you had a beautiful place, but they would make it into a wonderland of nature. And so every year they'd issue a new Wonderland brochure designed to entice folks out that summer to see the geysers of Yellowstone or to fish the rivers of northern Idaho in this wonderland. Now, if they embellished too much, the worst thing that was going to happen is someone would return from their vacation disappointed. But where they really created problems is in the brochures designed to lure farmers out west. When they embellished there, people acted on the belief that they were telling the truth, that one of the popular myths that turned out to be was that rain followed the plow. And so you could move to arid-appearing areas of Montana, and if you would break the soil, that rain would come and you would have a bountiful crop. And the railroads actually got university professors to testify to this, and I don't think they were dishonest. They actually believed what they were saying. What happened was that nature went through a wet cycle, and what they were saying appeared to be true until about 1918. And then many of those farmers that had taken out land in places like eastern Montana were literally driven out by the drought. And they blamed the railroads for that, and the railroads certainly deserve some of the blame because they embellished on the truth.
Now, one of the things that I think that you point out that's certainly true about the way that so many people travel today, being by plane, is that you don't really see anything. That is, you don't really see anything along the way. And of course, air travel. The great thing about air travel is that you don't spend your time traveling, so that then you can spend your time at your destination. You don't have to
Right.
You burn up all that time getting where you're going. But on the other hand, it's not at the speed at which you, and the speed and the height at which you travel, you don't see anything.
That's right.
And that's the, perhaps one of the ways that, that traveling has changed so much.
That's right. Even in the days of the DC-3 in the late 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and I'm old enough to remember traveling by DC-3 on American Airlines, you could still see and connect with the countryside below. And with the jet age, you're up generally well over 30,000 feet, and it's pretty difficult to have any sense of what lies below you. I remember one flight that absolutely mystified me that I had several years ago from Spokane, Washington, to Salt Lake City on a Delta. I think it was a 727. I don't even know if they have those anymore. But we kept flying between the mountains, and I thought, this is strange, because we were going over some high Rocky Mountain country, and we kept flying between the mountains. I'd never seen that before, but it was absolutely enchanting to look out and be able to see the mountains and actually see the tops of the mountains towering above the plane. Hmm. And when we got to Salt Lake, I asked the pilot, I said, he was standing there, as they often do, wishing people well as they left the plane. I said, you couldn't pressurize the plane, could you? And he said, no, we couldn't get above 8,000 or 9,000 feet. So, you know, it's not a practical way to fly, but it reminded me of the old days before planes were pressurized when you could connect with the landscape.
Yeah, I guess though, there's one story that somehow sticks to my mind about how early on they were flying low enough so that you could actually open the window, and
yeah,
they were really concerned that people were throwing their cigarette butts out the windows, and there would be starting forest fires. And apparently, some of the worst offenders were the pilots.
The pilots, and they were, and the pilots would often smoke these big fat cigars, and they would not extinguish in some of the higher elevations of the Rocky Mountains because the planes were clearing the tops of the passes by maybe 500 feet or less. And that was a big concern at one time. I find it so quaint to think about opening the windows of an airplane that people don't believe I'm telling the truth sometime.
Well, if you, off all your experience has been modern jet travel, the idea of opening the window sounds a bit fanciful to say
right.
The least. Our guest this morning is Carlos Schwantes. He's professor of transportation studies in the West at University of Missouri-St. Louis. He's author or editor of a number of books. He's written a lot about the history of the West. And this morning we're talking a little bit about his book, Going Places, Transportation Redefines the 20th Century West, and it's published by the Indiana University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. In the book, you talk about the fact that maybe there are three major kind of ways, at least three major ways, to think about how transportation changed the West. And one of those is maybe the most basic, is just the fact that it put an infrastructure into place. For example, if we're talking about the railroads, it put rails down and bridges and trestles and to make it possible for then people to get to places where it at the least it would have been difficult to get. How though now having this, if you take a place that was previously virtually uninhabited, very sparsely populated, putting a railroad through, how does this really change the place?
The land values tend to go up. You can take fertile land and raise crops and have no way to get those crops to market. And so at most you have a subsistence economy. You can feed your family and a few neighbors, but you're stuck trying to raise a large amount of wheat, for example, if you don't have a way to get it to market, particularly if it's perishable, if it's going to spoil at a particular point. And so with the railroads coming in, you could move crops to market efficiently, low cost, and people could then move into land that had been fertile but virtually unusable because whatever crops you raised couldn't get to market. And so the railroads opened that up. It also opened up areas to mining, say, copper, which didn't have a high intrinsic value for a given weight, but you wanted to move a lot of it. And if you moved a lot of it, you could make money. Well, it's not like gold or silver where you could move a fairly small amount by a burro and make money. So it opened up the economy of a very, very remote, hitherto remote part of the United States.
Certainly the railroad was, railroads at one time were a booming industry, more than they are today. Just how much power in terms of getting what they wanted, particularly in this region, did they have?
They had tremendous power because in so much of the West, once you developed crop agriculture, you really didn't have an alternative at one time. You didn't have rivers that you could float your crop to market on, except immediately along the Missouri River. The West simply was not well endowed with the kinds of rivers that we have in the Midwest and the East. So once the railroad was in place, once the farmers had come out, once they'd broken the land, once they'd planted a crop, they are heavily dependent on the railroads for success. And that's one of the reasons that after a while, there was a love-hate relationship with the railroads. At first, people loved them for opening up the countryside, but once people became dependent on them and the railroads could set freight rates almost willy-nilly at one time, many farmers came to hate them for their power, and they banded together and formed various kinds of agricultural organizations to protest and to use collective protest and political power to try to rein in the railroads. And so over the years, there was a lot of praise heaped on the railroads for developing the West, and then a lot of hatred because the railroads had such inordinately great power. And it wasn't until the highways became common, mainly in the 1920s, that you start to get serious alternatives to the railroads in many parts of the West. Railroads would hire legions of lobbyists to go in the state legislatures and make sure the state legislature did their bidding. And it was just a question of power. I don't know if there would have been any way that that wouldn't have happened. The railroads were simply the biggest game in town at one time, and so they wielded incredible power.
Having the railroads, and particularly being able to go coast to coast, changed things in America in so many ways. And I guess the one you write about it here in the book, and that I think maybe many people would not know about, is has to do with time and the fact that, in fact, the reason that we have time zones is the railroads, because they had to stay on time, and so for that reason, they invented the notion that there should be standardized time so that everybody, more or less, is going to be on the same time.
Yes, before time zones became common in the 1880s, transportation was so localized that it really didn't matter because every town or every district would keep its own time. And the railroads would simply pick a time. If you were connecting, say, Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati in Ohio, you'd simply pick a time. You'd pick Columbus time, for example, and the poor passenger was expected to figure out which time railroads were operating on when they connected between trains, and sometimes they missed trains because of the time differences. And as the railroad network expanded, this became intolerable, and so thinkers from various professions began to come up with different solutions, and one solution was to draw lines designating zones where all the places would be on the same time. So that's how we got Central Time or Eastern Time, Mountain Time, and so forth.
We're getting close to the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, and we have a caller I will get right to. Let me again introduce our guest. We're speaking with Carlos Schwantes. He's professor of transportation studies and the West at University of Missouri, St. Louis, and is author of a book that we're talking about. It's titled Going Places, and the subtitle is Transportation Redefines the 20th Century West, and it takes a look at how it is that transportation, and here really we're talking about trains, planes, and automobiles, how that changed the West. The book is published by the Indiana University Press. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. The caller here is in Belgium by Danville, and that would be line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask your guest about a couple items. First off, about the aspect of the railroads really had something to purport because to support because they acquired vast acreages in the West when they went to when they put their lines through in various places, and they obviously wanted to sell that land, which became very valuable to them. That they made a great deal of profit off of that. But the point I would like him to discuss a little bit more than anything else was the aspect that one of our favorite sons here in Illinois did a lot of work for the railroads, meaning Abraham Lincoln. Some of it was not particularly nice to the people he did with, but can you talk about his influence and how the railroads had their influence of him becoming president?
Well, I dealt mainly with 20th century, but I'm familiar with some of the things that happened there in Illinois. There's an interesting comparison between St. Louis and Chicago in terms of the railroads, because St. Louis, which was a much older place than Chicago, had a tremendous steamboat connection. You could take steamboats from St. Louis all the way into central Montana without changing. It was one of the longest runs in the world. You could go all the way to Fort Benton, Montana, the jumping off point for the gold mines in the 1860s. You could also go down to New Orleans. You'd go up to St. Paul, over to Pittsburgh, and so forth. So St. Louis had a tremendous investment in the steamboat infrastructure. Chicago, obviously, if it's going to go west, as it's starting to grow in the 1830s and 1840s, doesn't have the same advantage in terms of rivers. And so they start building railroads, particularly in the late 1840s, and are able to leapfrog what St. Louis had done because they don't have all this prior investment in the railroads, in the steamboats. And so people like Abraham Lincoln are simply typical of frontier lawyers who are helping to acquire the right-of-ways to also to be able to bridge streams, particularly the Mississippi River, where steamboat interests were opposed to railroads putting bridges across the river for fear that it could complicate navigation. I think they probably were also worried about competition. But yes, what Lincoln did, though, is very typical of frontier lawyers who are simply working for the railroad companies to help them acquire the right-of-way or the ability to legally do something with a new technology.
As I remember, it was Lincoln that won the Seminole judgment crossing the Mississippi because railroads initially invariably put their pilings in places where the steamboats would want to come and go.
That's right.
And they threw a great big fit in a lawsuit, and Lincoln was a lawyer for the railroads and ended up winning it in the Supreme Court, if I remember right.
Yes, that was in the 1850s, and that was a critical case in terms of being able to cross the Mississippi and then expand your network west into Iowa. So, yes, absolutely.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you. We have another caller here we'll get on to in just a moment. However, I have a news item I'd like to pass on to you this morning, just being reported by the Associated Press that the governor of Indiana, Frank O'Bannon, has been hospitalized in Chicago. The Chicago Fire Department says that O'Bannon was taken to Northwestern Memorial Hospital. He was at the Palmer House Hotel in Chicago when he reportedly collapsed. The Chicago Fire Department said O'Bannon was taken to Northwestern Memorial Hospital about 9 o'clock this morning. O'Bannon was at the Palmer House Hilton in downtown Chicago. The fire department said it didn't know why he was at the hotel. That's all the information we have on the story right at the moment. If we have more, of course, we'll bring it to you as it becomes available to us. We have another caller here in Indiana, in fact, in Avon, Indiana, so we'll talk with them next. They're on line one. Hello.
Well, good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Have a two-part question for your guest. First, in developing the West, who may or which technology made the greatest impact in terms of economic growth? Was it the railroads or was it the interstate highways?
I would argue that probably it was the interstate highways. But the railroads certainly can't be left out of the equation, because until the railroads spread a network of steel across the West, population centers were few and far between. Railroads made it possible for places like Los Angeles to develop into major urban centers, places like Las Vegas a little bit later on. But you're right. Once the urban West, the urban centers are developed in the West, then the interstate highways and the highways in general, I would argue that highways in general here made it possible to diffuse the benefits of transportation ever more significantly into the countryside, into smaller towns, into remoter places. And today, of course, the interstate highways are incredibly important in the transportation infrastructure of the West, as they are in the East. And they of course, date from the middle 1950s and the Eisenhower administration.
Okay. Now, the second part of the question, we're talking about improved surface transportation, high-speed rail links,
right.
For example, there's reconfiguring, rebuilding the property formerly of the Gulf Mobile in Ohio from Chicago, actually from Joliet, down to north of Mitchell, Illinois, I believe 110 miles an hour. $33 million has gone in just for the signaling aspect of this. Still, there's a lot more work to do, particularly your grade crossings, and you're going to go through a lot of these small towns. The rails mainly run from Central City to Central City, Union Station, Chicago, to what's left of Union Terminal there in St. Louis. People, businesses, everything's going to the burbs. How much success would federal expansions into this area of high-speed rail really develop the countryside the way in which the railroads did, in the early years, and the impact that the interstate highways has had?
I personally am not a firm believer in the value of high-speed trains, high-speed passenger trains in much of the United States. I think the high-speed passenger trains only work where the population has a density high enough to support them. In Europe, now you look at population density and you can justify the cost of high-speed trains. But it is, I think, hard to do so in much of the United States precisely for the reason you identified, and that is our cities tend to be so spread out, so diffuse, that I wonder whether I would actually drive to downtown St. Louis to catch a high-speed train to Chicago. that would depend, I suppose, on how easy the highway was, whether there was a safe parking facility for me to leave my car, as there is at the airport. And I really feel that unless we look at population density, that high-speed rail doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I did a calculation once that if people in the western half of the United States were living as densely in a densely populated area as they do in England, everybody west of the Mississippi could fit in the current state of Arizona. And then we could have high-speed trains all over the place serving our population. But we're so diffuse, particularly west of the Mississippi, the high-speed train would probably only work in a few locations like San Diego to Los Angeles, Portland to Seattle, Denver to Pueblo, places like that.
Have you had a chance to look at the proposal for this high speed between L.A. and Las Vegas?
I haven't looked at it in any detail.
What they want to do is build the middle. And at the two ends, bring that along later. Oh, my God, particularly when you look into the L.A. Basin area, the cost of property and property acquisition is phenomenal. But,
that's,
I mean,
right,
there's, you know, the promoters, and as it reminds me a lot of the Huxlers back in the early railroad promotion days, saying that this thing could be built for $9 billion. I'm going, how did they figure their math?
Where you see high-speed trains in Europe, these are government enterprises, and it's been a matter of state policy to put a high-speed train in from Paris to, say, the Mediterranean. And these are very expensive, oftentimes on dedicated right-of-way. And I don't see that as being really a practical answer to our problems here in the United States.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're just coming into our last 15 minutes, and I want to invite some other people who are listening. If they have questions, comments, they can get in on the conversation too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking with Carlos Schwattis. He's professor of Transportation Studies and the West at the University of Missouri-St. Louis, and is the author or editor of 14 books, has written a lot about the history of the West, and a book that we're talking about here this morning, which is titled Going Places, Transportation Redefines the 20th Century West, and it is published by the Indiana University Press. We've been talking here about both what's going on with railroads today and about the time, their importance in the opening of the West and the building of the West, how much money there was in this, how much power there was in this. The railroads went into decline, I guess, if I read your book correctly, maybe after World War I it began. And I suppose part of this has to do with the growing popularity of the automobile. But I'm not sure that would explain all of it. What does explain the decline of the railroads?
Well, I think it's important to point out that in some ways the railroads are better off today than they've ever been. In many parts of the West, they're hauling more freight than they've ever hauled. I was in Wyoming in July, and there's a section out there where they're hauling coal, and it's a four-track main line. I've never seen anything like that since the old days of the New York Central in upstate New York. Yes, in some ways they went into decline. What declined most was their passenger service. Once people had automobiles, oftentimes the automobiles were more convenient than a local passenger train, particularly in sparsely populated parts of the West. So much of the West, the most that a railroad could justify was one passenger train each way a day. And many people, when there was no alternative, they would sit at the depot and wait for the train and get on the train and go. But when they had an automobile and even passable roads, it didn't have to be paved roads, but passable roads, they could go whenever they wanted to. And they could go overland in ways that railway lines did not. You could shorten a trip by hours simply by taking an automobile along a route that the railroads did not serve. And so to a large extent, people found a workable alternative to the passenger train starting in the around the time of the First World War, around 1917, and then it just simply spread more and more through the West in the 1920s. In fact, the Westerners seem to have picked up on the automobile earlier than many Easterners, maybe because distances were greater, maybe because passenger train service was thin. In Southern California, certainly they could operate automobiles in an era before there was antifreeze, which we, of course, needed here in the Midwest to be able to operate our cars year-round. And so there are many reasons why Westerners abandoned the passenger train in favor of the automobile earlier, in many cases, than people in other parts of the United States.
Let's talk with another caller here in Atlanta, Illinois, on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. One of my favorite topics is railroads, and of course, if there's anybody talking about railroads, I try to call in. I agree with you wholeheartedly on the high-speed rail. I think, you know, trains, if they could run on a schedule, you know, the train that he was referring to through central Illinois here between Chicago and St. Louis, it can run 80 miles an hour, and a lot of times it does run 80 miles an hour or 79 miles an hour, and its holdup is usually when it gets to Chicago. And if you're going 80 miles an hour, you're really moving right up there. I mean, it doesn't take long to get from, say, Lincoln to Chicago at all. And I guess the question I want to ask you or discuss with you is, you know, passenger train business for the whole country. Obviously, I have friends that work for railroads, and railroads, as far as freight are concerned, are doing really well now, you know, with the commodities like grain and coal,
yeah,
like
that's
you
right.
referred to. They're doing really well. I mean, these engineers are working 10 to 12 hours a day and can't keep up with the job that's out there, at least with the numbers of engineers that are out there. But as far as passenger service, it seems like we've, you know, in the last four decades that we've had problems with making passenger service appealing, and I think it should either live or die on its own merits. And I think the main merit that we keep forgetting about is probably if you had full trains per passenger mile, as far as energy use, it's got everything beat, I would think. And if it doesn't, I would think it ought to go bye-bye. But, you know, I think that with modern equipment, you know, trains back in the 30s ran 125 miles an hour between Chicago and Minneapolis at times. So
yeah, we had faster trains then than we do today. And
it was a matter of track work, which, you know, the other person alluded to, and taking care of the structure. So you know, the traffic density as far as number of trains back then was greater probably today. They didn't have the tonnage, but,
yeah,
you know, the density was greater. So, I mean, and we didn't have computers to monitor this whole thing and keep it going. So we could do it fairly easy. But the bottom line is, and the question is, do you think with an energy policy that, you know, we ought to really, as a government, include trains in there? And I think the idea of, like, particularly to the West, like you say, is high-speed trains is just kind of ridiculous. If we can, the Santa Fe running between Chicago in L.A., you know, it could run at pretty high speeds, and that trip is pretty painless. Even today on Amtrak, that trip's pretty painless because that train moves right along, and it's usually on schedule. But if we could have trains on schedule and prove the energy efficiency of them because of the ridership, I think it still would have a major part in our transportation policy.
Well, I think we assume we're too altruistic if we would ride the train just to save energy. I know myself, that's probably in the back of my mind, but if the trains serving the St. Louis area only went downtown in the general vicinity of the Union Station and the parking facilities were no better than they are now, no matter how altruistic I felt about saving energy dollars, I'd probably go to the airport where the interstates provide easy access to the airport and business people provide parking facilities, private and also public. And I think the same thing is probably true up in Chicago, where you've got O'Hare Airport, well served by a variety of transportation facilities. It's much easier to go there and leave your car than I'm sure to go down to Union Station and leave your car. Maybe I'm wrong, but...
You're absolutely right, and having been to St. Louis many times and getting off in that dismal little station there back behind Union Station, and of course Chicago's always, I mean, there's really nowhere to park in Chicago. I mean, if you leave from here, it's fine because I can leave a car in Lincoln and be fine. But if you had the point I was trying to make, if you had a national transportation policy that stressed the need for railroads because of the savings in energy, you know, then the government would be involved and there would be parking at all those places, and or at least means to get in there easily from the suburbs to take a train somewhere.
Yes, and that's absolutely necessary. People just aren't going to ride unless it's convenient, no matter how compelling the idea of saving energy is.
Well, I thought it was a good argument, and it might have been, and I'm going to hang up. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. We have another standing by here, I believe, in Chicago, line number two. Hello.
Speaking of riding and talking about planes and trains and cars, how about the bus? You know, during the 70s when the Middle East suddenly raised the price of oil to the point where the world had not seen the transfer of wealth that amount ever in history practically to the Middle East because of the increased price of oil. And one of the things that occurred in the Scandinavian countries was a recognition of the fact that the cost and the supply was going to become a factor, and they decided to do something about the whole transportation compatibility between cars, buses, and trains especially, and they decided to develop the sort of universal pass, which allowed people to use on any bus or train within 50 miles of Stockholm, and this became incorporated into a lot of the turnstiles and other things where you don't have to use coins and so forth to gain access. But to get to the point of the buses, they decided that they wanted to make their transportation as attractive as possible for the automobile driver, and they improved the buses. They really made them deluxe. I mean, deluxe, like we hear of some of these celebrities and stars who ride around with their custom buses. Well, they went not to that extent, but they did improve the facilities with the air conditioning and the comfort of the seats, and even said that wasn't enough. They went on to even introduce steward service on the buses, serving you while you're on the bus, and really went all out. I don't know where it stands today, but they did recognize the bus as an alternative where the trains were not available for the different routes. And so that's a factor I think could be considered when we think of transportation. And as a follow-up on one more point, if you care to comment, where does the good old-fashioned monorail stand? Yeah, I was thinking of another term about monorail. Where does the monorail stand, and what do you think of buses?
Okay, first about the buses. In the United States, buses tried to compete with trains in a more upscale market as early as the 1920s. Buses actually were more comfortable to ride in some ways than trains in terms of seats. The buses introduced bucket seats, leather-covered seats, and so forth at a time when many train seats in the common coach were just bench-type seats with a scratchy, unpleasant fabric on them. And in the late 20s, early 30s, they even had sleeper buses in some parts of the West where you could ride overnight and have a bed in the bus. But during the Great Depression of the 1930s, the bus found its real niche, which was serving low-cost transportation. Today, the buses, the inner-city bus systems, have really fallen on hard times. After World War II, there was a big boom in the late 40s in trying to start bus companies. There's a wonderful memoir by Jim Lehrer that some of you will know from Nightly News, and he talks about his family starting up this bus company in Kansas and why it failed. There was a period of high hopes for the buses in the United States in the late 1940s and early 1950s, but today we have a skeleton network of intercity buses by comparison, and most of them seem to be serving a downscale market. In fact, I suspect they have a hard time competing with Southwest Airlines because sometimes the airline tickets are cheaper between large cities than it is to go by bus. So it is tough to try to revive the intercity bus market in the United States. As far as monorail, I spent a year in Seattle, and I always admired the monorail that came out of the World's Fair there, but it was a fairly short structure. I think monorail might make sense if it extended greater distances. It certainly is a technology that could be implemented down the middle of many interstate highways because it rests on a fairly narrow footprint. It wouldn't overwhelm the highway like an elevated railway system might. So I think it has its niche, but I don't think it's going to have any practical application, say, connecting St. Louis and Chicago.
We're to the point where we're going to have to finish, admittedly only having talked about a little part of this story. We've talked a fair amount about railroads and maybe a little bit about automobiles and hardly nothing at all about planes. So I guess what I would say is for people who are interested in reading more on this subject, you should head out to the bookstore and look for the book that we have been talking about by our guest, Carlos Schwantes. It's titled Going Places, the subtitle Transportation Redefines the 20th Century West, and it's published by the Indiana University Press. Our guest, Carlos Schwantes, is professor of transportation studies in the West at University of Missouri, St. Louis. And Professor Schwantes, I want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. I appreciate it.